Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And it is kind of close to the end of the week. So we've covered, finally, now let me see here. It's taken us a half a month just to cover Article 1. And right. In some cases, and welcome back, Paul. In some cases, you know, we had to get into some of the deep stuff. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did.
And there were points in time that I can think of just recently where we really meandered into, you know, a lot of other, you know, like enlightenment and discipline and that type of stuff. But the Constitution was truly a document that was developed from enlightenment that would lead us further down the path of enlightenment. And well, something happened because we're not on the path of enlightenment anymore. And, you know, it's just like, anywho. So we're actually in Article 2 now. And Article 2 goes through the roles and responsibilities of the president. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just said the executive branch. It was the same thing, right?
Yeah. Well, so actually, no, you're right. It goes through the president and the executive branch.
Okay.
Right? Because he has the power to create an executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
And to create offices and to request reports and those types of things. So, I mean, we'll get into that. But, yeah, it's just like the legislature, because even though Congress was authorized to be created, there were other things that they needed to create that was just a necessity for them to do their job. A great example of that was the General Accounting Office. Mm-hmm. Now, some people, when they look at the outlays, they would go, what's this thing over here, this General Accounting Office? That was actually created in year one, because they actually had to buy property. They had to go out and purchase, you know, consumables like, you know, ink, you know, feathers and quills for writing. You know, the people look at the, you know, I would love to see, you know, like an itemized list of their expenditures for office supplies and go, wow.
Right.
You know, where's the staples? Anyway. Obviously, they didn't have that type of stuff. They functioned in a completely different way, but they made do with what they had. And as far as I'm concerned, they were pretty doggone productive for what they yes. had to work with. So, anyway, anywho, so let's dive into Article 2. So, go ahead.
Okay. Section 1, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years and, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows.
Okay, so now that's a lead then to say this is how the president is going to be elected. Now, I have to forewarn everybody, and because, Paul, you're not even kind of aware of this, what we're going to have to do to go through this is we're going to have to go through this and the 12th Amendment.
Okay.
So as you can see, there's a little gap between, you know, the first section of red and the next section, and you'll notice that the next section is actually italicized.
Mm-hmm.
And that next yes. section is what was changed by the 12th Amendment.
Yeah.
And I'll try to emphasize this again, but when we actually go through the 12th Amendment, when going through this and then going through the 12th Amendment, people make a note in your head, and Paul, do the same thing. Make a note in your head as to what the Constitution dictates has to occur for the choosing of the president. In other words, you know, what the electors have to do. What is that process? And, you know, because people see a lot of words being changed, and that's only because of the details of the process. But go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors, equal to the whole number of senators and representatives, to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector.
Okay, so let's start off with that very first part. Let's start off with that very first part.
Okay. So these electors are separate people. They are not senators. They are not representatives.
Correct.
And they're not holding an office of trust or profit. Real quick, we may have covered this before. What is an office of profit under the United States? Just quick aside.
So an office of profit is a person that's not elected, but they're being paid. In other words, it's an employee. Like the people that were working in the general accounting office, they were being paid and they had this salary and, you know, they were employed by the federal government.
Okay. That answers my question. All right. So electors are separate individuals from senators and representatives. I think that makes it clear.
That is, but yes.
We're supposed to have the same number of electors as we have a total of senators and representatives.
That is correct.
Each state.
That is correct. So all in other words, each state is apportioned a quotient of electors, a number of electors that will be based upon the amount of senators and representatives that that state has collectively in Congress. So in other words, it doesn't mean if you're filling that seat, it's how many you're entitled to have. Let's say you've got a couple of seats that are empty. That doesn't mean that you can't have an elector because those seats are empty. It just means that you haven't filled those seats, but you also have two, you know, that those seats qualify for an elector as well. And you should have an elector for each seat. So let's look at the very first line, though. Can you explain this? Each state shall appoint. In such manner, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislatures thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives. So what does that mean?
excuse me, Chair. Mm-hmm. What that actually means is that it is the constitutional duty of the legislature to determine how electors are chosen, right?
Okay. But they also have another duty, because this was one of the things that they needed to figure out how to do this. Because when you look at it, because it's a no-brainer when it comes to a elector for your representative, that the people of that congressional district would have a right of representation in choosing the president for their their congressional district. Mm-hmm. How were the states to divide the senators, or I should say, how were the electors chosen for the Senate?
I think it depended on the state, Jer. For example, I think in some states, they may have been chosen at large.
And so actually, I sent this to you, and as soon as we started reading this, I go, you know what? I should have pulled that thing out, and I should actually have, you know, those, because I have the 12 years of the Electoral College and how each state chose their electors. And it was an evolutionary process, because there were certain states that when they went through this process, and some of them were actually states that debated the Constitution You know, because I can understand a state that didn't debate the Constitution to have questions on this whole process and go, huh, well, we interpreted it to be this way and actually interpret it maybe differently because they didn't get, you know, the benefit of the Federalists to explain what this process was, how this process was to work and, you know, so forth. So, okay. So let me get back into, you know, this very specific thing. Each state kind of had, or I should say there were a few states that did this differently. There were only it was a small number of states where the state legislators actually appointed those representatives. Now, when we went through the ratification debates, it was stipulated in the ratification debates that the people were to choose their electors.
Right.
In other words, the president is the, you know, the leader of the American people, and that they were supposed to choose their president, but not directly. So they were supposed to actually choose their elector, a representative that would then choose the president based on how they campaigned, because the electors were the ones that executed the campaigns, not the candidates.
Right.
Actually, the electors were the candidates because they were the ones that it was their names on the ballot, not the president.
Mm-hmm.
Not the, you know, the guy that you actually want to see get into office. It was the elector. You just voted for the guy who was committed to actually choosing the president that you wanted.
Correct.
So when they started implementing this, it was kind of interesting because it was, a hodgepodge of, you know, interpretation. And there were some states that divvied it up that allowed the people to choose the elector for the congressional district. So they got to choose their one elector, and the state legislature would choose who the electors would be that would represent them for the Senate, those two electors in the Electoral College for the Senate representation. So they chose their own. And then, you know, they were the ones that, you know, would after the election convene in the state and write down on the paper, you know, who they were choosing. Now, other states actually went down the path of allowing, you know, so I gave you the first two. One or two states where the state legislature just chose everything completely, which was outright opposite or outright, you know, contradictory to how the ratification debate said that this is the people's president and the people should choose. They should be choosing their electors. So, okay, so that was definitely going in the wrong direction. The one that kind of was pretty close to what you would have thought would have been, you know, the state legislature chose the two for the Senate and each congressional district chose their own. That would have been kind of like where I would have landed. But it actually went down the path where the, you know, all of the representatives were chosen by the congressional district, and then there were two at large.
Okay.
Now, a state could have, and I don't think there's any record of a state dividing. So, in other words, let's say half of the state, you know, got to choose, you know, here's the electors for that half of the state and another elector for the other half of the state to account for the two senators. In other words, split them. So everybody got a choice of voting for their one elector for the congressional district, then choosing the one at large for their half of the state. But I don't think any state went down that path because I think it was just more difficult. So, in other words, they were allowed to have these statewide campaigns for those who wanted to run statewide campaigns. And then there were those who wanted to just compete for that one seat for that congressional district. And but that's kind of how it went out, because by 1832, that's how all of the presidential elections were being performed. So that the people chose their electors, and the electors were the ones that actually wrote down on the ballots who they were going to choose for president. So if that's as clear as mud, Then let's move forward and read the italicize, because now, again, I've got to remind you and you folks, keep your thinking cap on and listen to what is expected of the lectors, how they're supposed to meet and what they're supposed to do. And then let's really, if you wrote this down on a piece of paper, okay, they do this in steps. And then you looked at what they, you know, the change of the 12th Amendment, you're going to be really, really surprised. Well, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, nor do I want to pollute the pool. So go ahead and read this process, and then we'll read the 12th Amendment. Go ahead.
Okay. Here's the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list of all persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certifications, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if there be more than one who have such majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president. And if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list, the said House shall in like manner choose the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states, and a majority of all states shall be necessary to a choice in every case. After the choice of the president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president. But if there shall remain two or more who have equal votes, the Senate shall choose from them by ballot the vice president.
Okay. Clear as mud, or do you want to go through that one more time? And maybe it would be really helpful. Folks, I don't think you could buy this kind of class. But maybe it would be helpful if you actually divvied this out. Now, I don't know if this would be something you'd want to do as a homework assignment, so it would not, you know, create dead air and so forth as you're writing and so forth. So maybe that would be the best way to do this. So that, because tomorrow's Feedback Friday, so the next time we're going to be meeting would be Monday. And it would be really good if you dissected these instructions and said, okay, you know, the electors are chosen, and this is what they have to do. This is how they choose the president and vice president. You know, and in this particular case, they write two names on a ballot. And only one of those names can be from the same state. In other words, you have to make sure that both names are not from the same state that you're living in. So in other words, if you're an elector in Virginia, then you can have one name on that ballot that is a Virginian, but the other name must be somebody from another state.
I'm glad you clarified that. So, because the way it's done is that currently is that the interpretation is the president and the vice president may not be from the same state. But that's not what this says, is it?
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, that is the whole problem with letting the party control this. But so, folks, when I get you to write this down, when I get you to actually visualize what these guys are supposed to do and how it's supposed to be settled, you're going to be surprised. I mean, even though the words are, you know, a good sized paragraph, this is a lot of words for an amendment, it's very little. The nuances will actually amaze you. But my point is that the nuances that they threw into the 12th Amendment, and this will be your take as well. This amendment was perfunctory, practically. I mean, it was a change, but and it required an amendment, but there wasn't that much that this amendment did differently. I mean, in other words, it, like I said, it injected a lot of words because it was kind of a wordy process, but you're going to compare the notes and go, is that all this did? And yet it demanded an amendment. And the takeaway is, look at what we're doing today, and we do not have an amendment for how far we've deviated compared to the little deviation that they demanded an amendment to be done in 1803. When was this done? Let's go to the 12th Amendment. We're going to go to the 12th Amendment now, so let's go ahead and do that. And this was done in 1803. Yeah, go ahead. So this is how it's supposed to happen now. This is how it's supposed to happen now.
Okay. Amendment 12. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots the person voted for as vice president. And they shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president, and of all persons voted for as vice president, and of the number of votes for each, which lists they shall sign and certify, and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directly to the president of the Senate. The president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if no person have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, the votes shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states, and a majority of all states shall be necessary to a choice. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them, before the fourth day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as president, as in the case of the death or other constitutional disability of the president. The person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president, which if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and no person have a majority, then from the two highest numbers on the list, the Senate shall choose the vice president. A quorum for the purpose shall consist of two-thirds of the whole number of senators, and a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice. But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States.
Okay.
That's a... Right.
So it's a mouthful, and there's a lot of words there. But when you really write it down, you're going to go, wow, they just kind of clarified and getting you to actually put it, you know, in one column what they did and in the other column what they changed. And, you know, when you pull it to a single couple of words like, you know, this, you're going to go, huh. Now, we ran out of time right here, so we'll be right back after this break. But the whole point here is to actualize what this amendment really did. And then you'll actually see that what the changes that they invoked in this lengthy amendment. Well, if the framers said that they had to do an amendment just to invoke these types of changes, then how is it that we're doing the process of choosing the president today without an amendment?
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so any thoughts on this, Paul?
So they've separated the election of the president from the election of the vice president.
Right.
They have also, they put... This is interesting that they inserted this thing here that the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them. That's an addition, but I don't know why they felt that was necessary. Why wouldn't the House of Representatives choose a president? You understand?
No. It says, and so hold on, read the whole thing. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice, in other words, if they were incapable of choosing the president for whatever reason, in other words, let's say we're being attacked by the British.
Okay.
And they're disrupting our election process.
Okay.
Let's say we're having, you know, this interference with China.
Okay.
And we just, you know, we're in a chaotic mode. And the House of Representatives does not choose. They're just saying that it's not saying that they refuse to. They just didn't be, for whatever circumstance.
So here's the question. It then says, then the vice president shall act as president. Which vice president? The one, the previous one, or the incoming one?
Okay, so it would be then the vice president was chosen. Because you got to understand, who chooses the vice president?
Well, the Senate chooses the vice president.
Not here. Not at this point. Not at this point.
Then the person having the greatest number of votes in the vice president shall be the vice president.
There you go. So let's say that they couldn't come up with a president, but they clearly got a vice president out of it.
Right. Okay.
And so in other words, the Electoral College was able to accomplish the choosing of the vice president, but they didn't choose the president. And Congress was unable to do it. For whatever reason, quorum, you know, attack, whatever, they just couldn't do it. So the newly chosen vice president would then take the realm or the helm of the presidency until the president is actually chosen.
That's right. So because the only reason that the House would have to choose is if there was a tie.
Yes.
Or there wasn't a majority.
And it's the same thing if there's not a majority for the vice president, then the Senate would have to choose. So they account for that as well. So they basically account for, they clean up the process of how if the Electoral College can't come up with a clear choice. In other words, how many shots does the Electoral College have in choosing the president?
Okay, first shot.
Because how many times have you heard that the Electoral College, if they can't choose the president the first time, they get a few extra shots at this?
They don't.
Not here.
They don't. I hear they don't have any shots at this.
They only have the one shot. They provide how many votes were cast. If they can't come up with a clear president and they don't have a clear winner, then it goes to the House.
Right.
So in other words, the Electoral College only has one shot. And if they fail America, that's okay, because the people also have representation in Congress. And the House of Representatives is the representatives of who?
The people.
The people will choose their president one way or the other, by their elector or by their representative in Congress, folks. This was the whole point of why it boiled down to who was to choose the president. The people. And so this is why. Go ahead. Keep going.
No, the other difference is that in the original Constitution, the person with the next number of votes became vice president. In this case, in the 12th Amendment, it's interesting the way they set it up. There's a separate ballot for vice president. But the vice president is, if there's a tie, is chosen by the Senate. Well, who's the Senate? Okay, the vice president is the president of the Senate.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the duties. And who's the Senate? Well,
it's the representatives of the state legislature.
Sure, it's the representatives of the state legislature.
Right.
It's so clean. It actually I think cleans up questions about the Electoral College and assigns the responsibilities to the correct houses.
Right. So I don't think this is rocket science. I think that anybody, if you just gave them a piece of paper and pen and sat down and said, write down what your job is as an elector based on Article 2 and then based on the 12th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare the notes, and you'll probably find that it's pretty minor. In contrast to today, where the electors don't even choose the vice president.
Correct.
The presidential nominee chooses the vice president. Folks, how in the heck did we get to that point? Where
that's a question.
Go
how
ahead.
Did we get to that?
Because the parties wanted to make it easier for them. They wanted to make sure that there would never, ever be a split between the Republican Democratic Party in the White House, just like they had with Lincoln and Jackson, or Johnson, I mean. With Lincoln and Johnson, you had a Democrat and a Republican president, Democrat vice president. They did not want to see that.
No. But that's a party-centric mentality. What about before that? You know what I'm saying? So
before they actually followed, because that's how they got a mixed presidency, or I should say a mixed executive, because the Electoral College and the parties go, you know, we can't let that happen. This is when a post Lincoln was when the uniparty formed to ensure the dichotomy of the parties. Mm-hmm. But what it did was it created the marriage of the parties.
So you're saying Lincoln was a Republican and Johnson was a Democrat?
I'm not saying that. That's the fact. He was.
That's what I got.
Okay.
All right.
In other words, if you look it up, yes. Yes, wow. Jackson was not Jackson. Johnson. Jackson was a Democrat. Yes, he was. But Andrew Johnson was a Democrat, a Southern Democrat.
Okay. And you know what's interesting is that's the way the system is supposed to work. You might have someone who would be lean conservative or Republican, and someone who, as a vice president, who would lean, Democrat. But that's the way the system is designed.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And And again, the system is designed so you got this, you have the states involved and you have the people involved. And really, it's a perfect system like no system that has ever been created.
Right. It actually comes down to the will of the people. In other words, right. We don't care what you guys in the party and everything else. We want what we want. And the party created this insurance plan by primaries and creating tickets and winner take all. Now, that's what I'm saying, folks. When you look at what we're doing today and how we're executing, you know, the 12th Amendment and i.e. Article 2 of the 12th Amendment, it is nothing. We're that far off. We're that far off. Because we can go back to Article 1 when I talked about how the Senate and the representatives themselves are really, truly not how the states are violating these federal laws by creating primaries.
Correct.
You cannot – the criteria for a person to become a senator, for the person to become a president – you throw your hat in that ring, you're in that race to the end. You cannot be eliminated. The states do not have any authority to eliminate a federal candidate. The problem is so they said, "Oh, well, we're going to alleviate, you know, having too big of a field so that, you know, we have to do runoffs or what have you." Let me ask you this, folks. Do you think America would be better off if the people actually started choosing their leaders instead of the globalist appointing and putting into, I mean, because that's how it's going today. The globalists are spending the money and making sure that their guys get in.
Right.
So, you know, we have the government that is, you know, precisely what the globalists are paying for instead of having our own self-government. We are better off having more and more. And even if we have to do two or three runoffs or however you do it, so you only have one runoff, we're better off having that extra election. And so here's think about it this way. You're already spending an insane amount of money just to have a primary every year. Do right. away with the primary and do a runoff. Let the people choose what that should be. Let the people choose their electors and let the people, you know, choose who they want to represent them at every level. If you need to have a runoff, that's fine. But if you don't, at least you're not straddled with it because the party guarantees that you're straddled with it. There are some states that have primaries, they have general elections, and they have runoffs.
Sure.
At the expense of the people. The parties have actually convinced us to spend our own money so that they can have better control over our elected.
Correct. Absolutely. And, you know, consider, you know, the parties actually aren't government organizations. They're private clubs. So why are we paying to downsize voter choice from members of your public private club?
To increase, you know, the control to power and money, to increase their control over it.
Right.
That's why. So, okay. But I would ask anybody and everybody, Paul, if you want to do it, you're more than welcome to. You're going to realize, oh my gosh, this was a really minor amendment, even though there's a lot of words here. And, it, you know, there were some changes, but in comparison to what we're doing today, how in the heck are we doing these presidential elections without the amendment to authorize that type of change?
In other words, without following the – why are we not following the Constitution?
Right. Yes. Because they don't want to, because this is what serves them. That's why. Okay. So you ready to move on or do you want to go more?
I am ready to move on.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we're back up, folks. Back up to Article 2, Section 2 now. No, we're still in Section 1.
I'm still in Section 1. There's a little bit still here. So – the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States.
Yes.
No, except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president.
Okay. So hold on here. Let's go back up to the top. This right here, the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. So
okay.
Does that mean that the federal government is the one that actually sets the days of elections? I mean, for the most part, there's been this kind of agreement that, okay, the first Tuesday, and actually, I think you, there was one year, was it this year, or there was a recent year where it fell on the first Tuesday, and you told me about the rule.
I remember that, and I don't know. It's the first Tuesday, right. It is the first Tuesday after the first Monday.
In other words, there has to be a Monday for that first yes. Tuesday. In other words, correct. If the first day of the month is a Tuesday, then right. it will be on the second Tuesday.
That's correct.
Okay.
That is correct. It's always the first Tuesday after the first Monday. And so, so what this says is that electors shall give their votes on the same day.
Okay. But so right. hold on here. Go back up to the beginning of Article 2.
Okay.
Each state shall appoint in a manner as the legislature thereof may direct.
Correct.
In other words, they're the ones that choose the process of mm-hmm. the election. In other words, how they're to do that. Now, when you look at this, the Congress may determine the time and the choosing, okay, but not the manner. The point is, if you go all the way up to Article 1, and I want to say it's probably Section 2 or 3. No, it'll be 4, right? The times and place and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But Congress may at that time, by law, make or alter such regulations except to the places of choosing senators. So, okay. In other words, with a federal election, Congress can actually, you know, get involved in the time and the place and the manner for both representatives and senators. Okay. They can get involved in that. But when it comes to the presidential election, the reason this is important and the reason I'm really emphasizing this is if you look at what it says here, Congress may determine the time of choosing and the day on which they should give their votes. That's it. They don't choose the place, nor do they choose the manner.
Right.
The manner is locked tight to the state legislators, which means that the state legislatures have full cognizance over the choosing of the president to make sure that the people get to choose their president.
Right.
And the state legislatures buckle to the party as well. So, okay, I just wanted to, I know I'm really emphasizing this, but that's a nuance that you lose with the federal election for senator and representative, where Congress can kind of do just what the state legislatures could do, but they can't here.
So it's correct. All right. And you said something earlier that's really cool. I didn't get a chance to mention it, but you said, if you were to have someone sit down, okay, uh-huh. and let's say a citizen of the United States sit down with a piece of paper and draw out, you know, what the Second Amendment would...
What the 12th Amendment, do, yeah, okay.
That, okay, when you said that, it hit me, okay? If I did this, if I took any 10 people in the United States and asked them that question, I don't think I would get a one of them to get it correct. That's why we're doing this.
Well, so actually, if they sat down and they extrapolated precisely what it says, you'd probably get a lot closer. I mean, you can give somebody a formula. I mean, I've seen math formulas where people get it wrong because they don't understand the rules of functions, like, you know, the rule of multiplication and division, you know, parentheses or what have you. You know, that those rules, those rules take precedence over the simple math and, I should say, addition and subtraction. So like if you got a formula and in the middle of it, you've got this little multiplication function, then you got to do that first before you add a number to that function. Does that make sense? So there's those little rules like that, that when you look at it, you tell somebody, well, figure this out. Well, yeah, they'll actually figure that out, but they won't be able to, you know, extrapolate, you know, it correctly unless they know those rules. Well, I think you'd be more accurate. I think that you'd have a greater chance of having an equal extrapolation than you would with some math and those types of things that you have to understand rules to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that the presidential selection process has been so corrupted that people won't recognize either Article 2 or the 12th Amendment. You know, it would be completely new to them. I think that's what I was trying to say.
Right. I see what you're saying. So, in other words, if they look at what we're supposed to do and then they go, hold on here, why are we doing what we're doing? It would really wake them up. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why I said, that's why we're doing what we're doing. Okay, that's right. Why we're doing this presentation on the Constitution, and so that's the point I wanted to make.
Yes.
Okay. So we went over Congress determining time of choosing.
Now we're talking about natural born citizen.
No person except a natural born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. And it gives a couple others. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States.
Okay.
Now, okay.
So you want to know how Congress further defined the naturalization and a natural born citizen?
Yes.
This is the Naturalization Act of 1790. The children of citizens of the United States that may be born beyond the sea or out of the limits of the United States shall be considered as natural born citizens, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to persons whose fathers have never been resident in the United States. In other words, they hadn't not visited, but lived in the United States. Now,
let me ask you a question.
In a previous show, I mentioned something. And if you look at this, see, this doesn't account for, or it does. So what happens if a single citizen, a woman or a man, they're on business for the United States, emissary, what have you. They're abroad and they get married and they have an inter-citizenship, you know, marriage where, sure, you know, the two different nations. What happens when they produce a child? They produce a child that is born with multi-citizenship.
Citizenship. Okay.
Okay. So when they say the children of citizens, it just means it doesn't mean that you have to have two citizens. It means that, you know, the citizens that are abroad, the children of them that may be born beyond the sea or out of the limits of the United States shall be considered as natural born citizens, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to persons whose fathers, in other words, the father at a minimum, even if he wasn't a citizen, but the father at least had to be a resident of the United States at some point in time. He had to have been at least a resident. Obama's father never was a resident. was not a citizen, correct, nor was he a resident. And this is why they didn't want anybody to truly dive into this, because that man was not qualified based on the compact. Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So, is this still valid? Has this been repealed?
So hold on.
Okay.
This has been redefined by the court. See, one of the things that, you know, when Congress has to clarify or define something that's within their purview, then that's what they did. And they went through the Constitution and said, we have to define this. We have to define this. So when they defined this, when the framers defined this, that actually became the hard cast in stone definition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The only way they passed this act to establish this. Now, they could pass an act to add to this, but not to change this.
Okay. And this was 1790.
1790, so was, correct.
Right. This was as early as they probably could have done it.
Right. Well, right. So what they wanted to do was they wanted to lay waste to any conflict as to what a natural born citizen was.
Okay.
They wanted to make sure that there was no confusion on what that line in the Constitution meant. So they defined it.
Okay.
Now, down the road, they actually redefined, not redefined this, but they added to the definitions of the naturalization process and what it would take, and created, you know, laws that, you know, created a uniform rule of naturalization. This was just the law of how a natural born citizen, you know, was defined. So down the road, their courts stepped in. And they basically ignored this. They looked at the Constitution and said, we believe it means this. And they have no authority to do that.
Okay.
They have no authority to do that. Because if it's not granted to them, and even though it's clear that, you know, a natural born citizen arises under this Constitution, that they have jurisdiction over that, when a definition is provided, a term or definition of the compact is actually provided, they can't go and redefine it. Because this is how Plessy v. Ferguson and how the persecution and Jim Crow laws and all of these terrible things occurred in America. Because the courts actually started redefining it, because they, you know, they didn't like what was going on. They wanted, and they literally had agendas to change and drive, you know, the certain outcomes to actually persecute blacks in America, or, you know, people or what have you.
Right.
And the reason they got away with it is because nobody questioned the fact that they had the authority to do that when they didn't. You cannot redefine something in a compact that was set in stone. Once it's set in stone, you cannot redefine. Thank you for coming, Paul. We've ran out of time. And so we'll have you back on next week. And so, folks, I'm just hoping that this, you know, this is as much of a treasure as I find the Constitution, these conversations and so forth, as we go through these definitions. And this is why we go through the ratification debates as well. But as I say, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.